welcome to this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are glad that you are with us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit, historian Dr. Tom Easern uncovers a long-overlooked bulletin that helped the state's last generation of homesteaders make a life on the Northern Plains. And in Tech with Peck, George Peck shares his concerns about using ChatGPT to analyze personal health records, and also, can radio survive the age of podcasts and streaming? And we begin today's Main Street with a discussion about rising hunger and falling water. This is A Closer Look with the Monitor. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Today we have a two-part conversation with reporters from the North Dakota Monitor. Later, we'll explore declining water levels at Lake Sakakawea and the challenges they're creating. But first, a record number of people across North Dakota and Clay County, Minnesota are seeking help, putting food on the table. The Great Plains Food Bank says 186,000 people received assistance through its network during the latest fiscal year. That's a 16% increase from the year before. That means one in four people across its service area rely on a food pantry or another hunger relief program. North Dakota Monitor reporter Michael Ochterlein has been examining the numbers, what they reveal about food insecurity here in the region, and whether the region's hunger relief network can keep pace with the growing demand. Michael, I wish we were talking about something a little more fun to talk about, but welcome back to A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Yeah, I do too, Craig, but thanks for having us.
The Great Plains Food Bank, as you've noted, serves 186,000 folks. How does that compare with the numbers it's previously seen?
Going back in to 2024, the previous fiscal year, it was 151,000. So you're talking a 35,000 person increase. And these are unique people. These aren't just, you know, one person comes in and you count them multiple times. This is a single person or a child or a household that comes in and gets a food box or participates in some of their programs. The number of visits have been increasing faster than the actual number of people served.
And that's important too, right? Because that really shows the need.
It does. And it's showing that they're coming back for multiple visits, which means it's a more sustained food insecurity for that household. When I talked to Ann Prifferal, the CEO of Great Plains Food Bank, I mean, she doesn't want to report on record numbers at the Great Plains Food Bank. She wants the opposite. She's like, we decreased. That's what she wants. But in this case, you know, you really do need to point out that it was a record this last fiscal year for the amount of people served in North Dakota and Clay County right next door to Fargo.
And even heavier on the heart to me, and I think to our listeners, is one in three children across the food bank's service area received assistance. What does that tell us about the extent of childhood hunger in the region?
Well, the way Ann put it is it's just there are more children in households that are food insecure. And she said that the number of children that have been coming and getting meals increased 23%. It's the fastest growing percentage or block of people receiving food assistance is children. And actually, to tell you the truth, Craig, I just went to the Dream Center in Bismarck. They're a food distribution site and they prepare meals 365, 7 days a week. They're seeing more grandparents coming in with their grandkids, taking care of their grandkids. And, you know, it's just kids are just in situations more where there are more food insecure now than they were before.
Does your reporting, Michael, reveal about the circumstances that are bringing individuals and families to food pantries? And again, these aren't the things we see on TV on the East Coast or somewhere. These are here.
Right. These are your North Dakota neighbors all across the state. The Great Plains Food Bank has, you know, more than 200 in their network across the state of organizations that they help service and distribute food to. What it means is people are struggling. Kind of the way they put it is it's inflationary costs. It's gas prices. It's higher insurance costs. All of a sudden you're paying more for these items and you have less money to spend at the grocery store, of which those food prices are also increasing. So it puts people in a very precarious situation where they feel like they do need to reach out to the food shelf, their local food shelf, for assistance. And I also think that it should be telling that North Dakota has one of the lowest unemployment rates in the entire country. It's South Dakota and then it's North Dakota right there. I think we're hovering right around 2%. So it's the fact that these people are working It's these people are working one, two, maybe even three jobs to try and get by, and they're still struggling to make ends meet. Then they turn to the food pantry, and the food pantry is there. They want to make sure everybody gets fed in this state. And yeah, it's just it's really tough to think about that, even when you're trying so hard and you're working a job, that you still need to reach out for assistance. But they want you to know, these organizations want you to know, they are there for mm-hmm. you to yeah. use in these circumstances. So you shouldn't feel ashamed when you go in. You shouldn't feel any stigma. They're trying to help. Like I said, I just, the Dream Center in Bismarck, they said that if they can take the worry of having a meal off of your plate, or for lack of a better term, off of your plate, then you can worry about buying that pair of shoes for the kids, or you know, getting the car fixed, or whatever. So they're trying
school
to
school starting
some,
right,
exactly. Oh my school. Gosh, school supplies. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Michael, the irony of those numbers, the unemployment number being so low, that's great news, right? I mean, people are working, but yet not being able to meet ends meet just to put something on the table for their children is just heartbreaking. Is this a need in certain communities, Michael, or is it really felt throughout the whole service area of the Great Plains Food Bank?
Really didn't try to narrow in. We wanted to stay kind of, you know, 30,000 feet statewide. Mm-hmm. But with my conversations in Bismarck, I mean, they're serving, you know, 1,000 people a week, you know, doing food distribution events, and they're doing 200 bag lunches a day. Giving out those bag lunches every day. And, you know, their clientele, they said it's about 30% native, which is higher than the general population of the Bismarck-Mandan area. But it probably depends on the area, and it depends on what resources are available to these food shelves, especially since I'm assuming we'll talk later about some of the federal government cuts that have had these organizations turn to more community-based solutions.
Michael, you talk about federal programs. As demand has increased, the food bank received nearly 1 million pounds fewer pounds of food through a federal assistance program. What did that reduction mean for the organization and its local partners?
So the program's called the Emergency Food Assistance Program. The federal government provides food to some of these organizations, but this year there were cuts. And the Great Plains Food Bank got about 1 million pounds less. So that forced them to turn to, you know, organizations, businesses in the community. I mean, we're talking Costco, we're talking Walmart, we're talking your grocery stores. If there's things that are about to expire or the sell-by date's coming up, they will donate them to the food pantry. And so you're kind of pivoting and relying more on those community donations, but also purchasing food to fill gaps that they may not have had before. And so then you're using your own financial resources to purchase food that you didn't have to purchase before because the federal government had been taking care of it. And so it just kind of gets you on the fiscal side as well for some of these organizations.
So that's how then the food bank actually distributed 14.4 million pounds of food, which was an increase from the previous year, despite losing 1 million pounds of food from the federal government. Is that how it was able to move forward, is by local organizations just kind of, for lack of a better explanation, stepping up?
Yeah, really, that's kind of what they're relying on right now. Yeah, these surplus food programs, a lot of them are organized through the Great Plains Food Bank. And it might be your local food shelf that's doing the legwork on the ground with the trucks and everything, but it's all organized through them. And community donations are a huge part of this. We're talking, I mean, increased food drives. You talk to Ann at the Great Plains Food Bank and at the Dream Center, it's the volunteers. Yeah. It's people signing up, wanting to help any way they can. And so they rely on, you know, volunteer service. They rely on these donations now more than ever, especially with the cuts of some of these federal programs.
And now the food bank is building a new statewide distribution center in Fargo. How will that facility change its ability to respond to the need that we've just talked about?
Well, the way Ann described it, it's going to give them more space. It's going to give them more space to hold food. It's going to give them more opportunity to distribute larger amounts of food. But also there's going to be a community center aspect to it, you know, in a kind of a base for volunteer operations. So she describes it as a very kind of all-encompassing facility. So I'd be really excited to see it when it does finally finish. You know, with demand, you need more larger operations, and that's what this new site's going to do.
And is this new demand, this higher demand, seen by folks as a temporary surge, or is it part of a new longer-term normal, if you will, in food insecurity?
One thing I point out in my story is the Great Plains Food Bank is also a member of Feeding America. Now, that's a national organization, a national food distribution kind of charity where they focus on distributing food nationwide. They track the number of food insecure households by state. And if they go back to 2020 for North Dakota, and you can see the number of food insecure households and people in North Dakota increases each year. So it is not a problem that seems to be going away. It is something that just continues to rise annually. And there's not an easy solution to this.
Do the folks at the food bank weigh in on what a potential solution needs to be?
Yeah, I mean, obviously increased donations, increased volunteers, but ultimately it comes down to restoring these federal programs. The SNAP funding, when the government shut down, there was a SNAP funding cuts, lower levels of benefits were paid out. In some cases, those lower level benefits continued into this year and even to today. So people are getting less from the federal government in terms of SNAP relief. And obviously the food distribution, the emergency food assistance program, they're getting less in terms of actual food too. So these are federal programs. It needs a federal solution. They would tell you that they would encourage people to call their representatives in Congress to make the case to restore these programs or bolster them, obviously, because there is still a need for it that increases every year. It seems to be kind of in a stalemate with these federal programs.
Michael Ochterling is a reporter with the North Dakota Monitor. You can read his reporting about statewide food insecurity at thenorthdakotamonitor.com. It's always free, never paywalls or subscriptions. Thank you, Michael, for joining us.
Thank you for having us, Craig.
A closer look with the Monitor continues on Prairie Public. Lake Sakakawea is one of North Dakota's most important recreational and economic resources, but falling water levels are making parts of the lake increasingly difficult to reach. Some boat ramps and marinas have closed, while those that remain usable are handling additional traffic. Resort operators are moving docks, adjusting their operations, and watching the shoreline retreat. North Dakota Monitor reporter Jeff Beach visited communities along Lake Sakakawea to see how the water is affecting resorts, anglers, and recreational boaters. Jeff, welcome back to A Closer Look with the Monitor.
Thanks for having me, Craig.
For someone, Jeff, who has not visited Lake Sakakawea, how noticeable is the low water?
It's pretty noticeable, especially I think in the western reaches of the lake. Lewis and Clark State Park was where I first was kind of taken aback by how low the water was, you know, around 4th of July weekend. And it's easily recognizable how low it is there. Some other places might be less so. Some of the areas where it's a little bit shallower already, that's where it's probably most noticeable.
Do we know how the lake's current elevation compares with what would be typical at this point in summer?
Yeah, according to the Army Corps of Engineers, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we were about 12 feet below normal. You know, it's been dropping since that time, you know, an inch or two, just about daily. So it might be closer to 13 feet by this time.
That seems like a lot of water to me. What has caused the water level to fall?
You know, the big thing is the snowpack, the snowfall in the Rocky Mountains. The lack thereof, yes, over the last winter. So, you know, that feeds into the upper reaches of the Missouri River and the Yellowstone River, of course, is a major tributary, but several tributaries that come from the Rocky Mountains had very little runoff this spring from a lack of snow.
You talked about a boat ramp or marina that becomes unusable. It really impacts then the access points that remain open. Give us a sense of how that is.
Yeah, so Van Hook Resort, Van Hook Arm, kind of on the north side of the lake, is one of the most popular put-in sites, access sites for boaters on the lake. The Army Corps of Engineers owns the land, the lakeshore around the lake. They use kind of partnerships with local entities like park boards or park departments, and who then may contract with a resort owner to kind of do the daily work of moving docks to the appropriate level and keeping the parking lot clean and the fish houses, you know, maintained and all those kinds of things. And And, you know, so there are certainly longer lines at these access points, more time to get on the lake, get off the lake when it comes time to end the day. They rely on a lot of the boaters to kind of police themselves as far as, you know, maintaining order to the situation. But people will encounter longer wait times for sure. You know, there have been some instances where people have had some short fuses or gotten impatient with people who are maybe taking longer than they think they should getting off the lake or getting their ramp moved or getting their boat trailer moved out of the way, those kinds of things. So the resort operators, you know, really emphasize trying to be patient with people, especially if they might not be as experienced as you are, and, you know, be willing to offer a helping hand instead of perhaps chastising those that you feel like are slowing things down. So patience is a real virtue in the situation.
Plus, we go to the lake to have fun.
Yeah.
This lake, of course, is in northwest North Dakota. Jeff, what are resort and marina operators having to do then to keep their businesses operating as the shoreline recedes?
The biggest thing that they need to do is maintain access to the boat ramps. And sometimes that's just not becomes undoable anymore. And they're trying to, you know, they will lose access to some ramps, but it might mean, you know, putting down more gravel or rock to make sure people can access a ramp. They might need volunteer labor or volunteer equipment, volunteer materials to kind of help keep those access points available, drivable, so that people can keep getting in and out.
Have you been able to discern what the economic consequences have been now for these resorts and other businesses that really depend on lake traffic?
Yes, I don't know if we'll really see the real impact this year. You know, people have scheduled their vacations this year, you know, and they probably maintained those reservations and, you know, made do the best they can. It's the big question, I think, is, you know, how many of those people are going to come back next year if they felt like they had, you know, a less than stellar experience getting on and off the lake or had to drive farther to get to an access point. So that I think will be the kind of next year's story more so than this year.
At Lake Sakakawea, has the lower water changed the risks for anglers and recreational boaters?
Yes, there certainly are sandbars, logs, rocks exposed or now just below the surface that were certainly a safe distance below the surface in years past. So people do need to be aware of the lake depth wherever they might be boating and proceed accordingly. Proceed with caution.
Do we know what the Army Corps of Engineers, have they weighed in on what they expect to happen at the lake for the remainder of this season?
Yes, I think, you know, they expect the lake to be continuing to draw down, which is typical in the late summer and the fall when we get into a drier period. You know, the peak lake would usually peak earlier in the summer. So you know, unlikely to see any significant change, or at least change for the better for the lake level this summer. And really the forecast models that they have for snowfall in the Rockies again for this coming winter and runoff again in the spring are below normal or below average. And so it's likely going to be a problem again next year.
Where can visitors look to get the best information about boat ramps and other information that they need before they head to the lake?
Yeah, the Army Corps of Engineers does maintain an interactive map that shows which ramps are open and which ones aren't. It's maybe a little bit difficult to find, but if you do a Google search, you should be able to find the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers ramp site.
Jeff Beach, he's a reporter for the North Dakota Monitor. He visits with us periodically here on A Closer Look with the Monitor. You can read his work and all of the great reporters at the North Dakota Monitor, free from subscription charges and free from paywalls, at NorthDakotaMonitor.com. Jeff, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Craig.
Theater Without Walls presents The Cream of Wheat Caper, a melodrama on the Red River, August 15th and 22nd at 7 p.m., and August 16th and 23rd at 2 p.m. at the Myra Museum in Grand Forks. The production is supported by an arts re-grant from the City of Grand Forks, with additional support from the Community Foundation of Grand Forks, East Grand Forks, and Region.
This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. A long-overlooked agricultural bulletin offers a revealing look at the advice given to North Dakota's last generation of homesteaders. Here is historian Dr. Tom Ezern with Plainsfolk.
I've been giving talks and writing scripts about the Homestead Act. Thought I knew the literature, and then this pops up, Hints for Homesteaders, 1907, by Lawrence R. Waldron. Now, how have I missed this? Not just me, but all the other more accomplished scholars of homesteading. How have we missed this? So here it is, just between you and me. Hints for Homesteaders is North Dakota Agricultural Experiment Station Bulletin number 74, and the first bulletin to emanate from the Dickinson Substation, now NDSU's Dickinson Research and Extension Center. The legislature provided for this ag research station in 1905, and for a particular reason. North Dakota was settled, the common narrative says, in two surges of settlement. The first Dakota boom, 1878 to 1886, more or less, and the second Dakota boom, 1900 to 1915, the two eras corresponding to bursts of railroad construction, with the depression of the 1890s in between. The second Dakota boom poured homesteaders into the West River country. The legislature and the agricultural college figured there should be a research station in the emerging region to help homesteaders figure it out. The college sent young Waldron to get the work started. He was a Michigan boy who, when he was ready for college, came out to NDAC in Fargo because his elder brother was on the faculty there. He got his bachelor's degree, taught at the AC a while, went back to Michigan for an MA, got married, and settled in for a while as an assistant botanist at the AC. After that, well, he must have been looking for a challenge because he took the job at Dickinson. And a challenge it was. The tract of land they gave him to work with was not choice. A visitor said the site was not a likely one. High ground with a hogback running diagonally across it, soils light, which may have been fortuitous. Waldron was a youngster, expected to dispense advice to a homesteading public. He needed to plant trees where they required help to survive, to break prairie, to start from scratch. Within 2 years, drawing both from his initial experiences on the ground and from the literature coming from other Great Plains frontiers, Waldron came out with Hints to Homesteaders, intended for broad distribution. The title page declared, "Any farmer, teacher, or student in the state may have this bulletin mailed to his address free of charge upon application." Excerpts from it were reprinted widely in country town newspapers. I would not say Waldron wrote the Bible on homesteading, the semi-arid lands of the northern plains, but he wrote the catechism. He wrote, he said, "With a view of aiding somewhat the many settlers engaged in opening up the new lands of North Dakota, particularly the drier regions." Dickinson averaged less than 15 inches of precipitation per year. Waldron assumed a modest posture, saying the advice he dispensed was not necessarily the last word, but it was grounded and validated, and it was needed. "A large number of homesteaders do not need elementary education along the lines of good farming," he said, "but they find here conditions quite different from those to which they are accustomed." Years later, Waldron would be recalled to the Fargo station and installed as its first dedicated wheat breeder. He's listed in various agricultural halls of fame and released multiple named wheat varieties, especially suited to weather the plagues of rust so common here. But I'm going to devote more time to Waldron's formative years on the Western Plains, when he worked shoulder to shoulder with the last generation of homesteaders.
Lawrence Waldron would go on to become a celebrated wheat breeder, but first, he helped newcomers confront the difficult realities of farming Western North Dakota. This was Plainsfolk, written and presented by Dr. Tom Ezern, Distinguished Professor of History at North Dakota State University.
Still ahead on this Thursday's Main Street, ChatGPT and your personal medical history, plus the history and demise of radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Radio has survived television, satellite broadcasting, the internet, and countless predictions of its demise. But today, traditional AM and FM stations compete not only with one another, but with podcasts, streaming services, and almost an unlimited supply of on-demand audio. What keeps radio relevant? Can newer technology such as HD radio, I don't know that that's really new anymore, strengthen it? And what might radio sound like in another decade? But first, on Tech with Peck, this Thursday, we'll examine a new development quickly from OpenAI, health. In ChatGPT allows users to connect supported medical records and Apple Health information, and the service can provide responses informed by their personal health history. It connects to Stanford's medical record and to Essentia Health's medical record. OpenAI says that the information receives additional privacy protections and is not used to train its foundation models or target advertising. The company also cautions that ChatGPT, and we've said this before,
may introduce hallucinations.
George Peck joins us on Tech with Peck. George, welcome back.
Thank you. Nothing like talking about OpenAI and then radio.
Okay? Radio, right. Yeah. These new technologies and the old. But let's start just briefly with health in ChatGPT. It was just announced by OpenAI on July 23rd, I believe, and it could allow someone to learn from medical records, lab results, or information. You can query it. You can ask it a dozen questions about your medical records. We've talked about it before, but now here it is. George, what do you think?
Yeah, well, you and I just introduced it to each other. I was not aware of it until you told me about it a few days ago. UC Health, who is my provider, appears to be one of those that will let you connect up their data. Before I knew about this, I will admit to have done some very limited health research via an AI agent. And I'm just a little nervous about it in terms of, again, just the potential for hallucination. I've just a very vivid memory, Craig, of an AI search I did a while back. And the answer was, you can do this in seconds. It was a particular thing where I wanted to take some audio and video and remultiplex it and just some geeky stuff with my movie collection. But the answer from AI was, yes, you do this using this tool and it takes just seconds. Well, in my case, it took about 4 hours worth of seconds. And it wasn't a, you know, showstopper, the world is going to stop hallucination. But what had happened was some other person who had, you know, been used to train it had done what he had done in seconds because he had a 5-second video file, not a 2-hour video file. The problem was AI didn't make that distinction and just blanketly said in seconds. That was a hallucination I'm not going to soon forget. And that kind of thing makes me a little more nervous when I'm talking about health discussion, particularly health advice. So I would say it would be possible potentially to ask some health general direction questions and look at what general directions are or what prevailing opinions are. But it is so tempting to hook your health records up to OpenAI. That adds context to an agent. The more context, the more accurate of a response you get. So that would add some trust to it. But still, with that context, you are invariably going to ask some kind of a health recommendation. What should I take? What medication should I take? Should I take it in the morning? Should I take it in the afternoon? Can I take it with this medication? Is it okay if I have a martini while I'm taking this? I would be very concerned about the accuracy of the answer. So if you are thinking about doing this, I'm not quite yet. I would go out and probably do the same research I would have done outside of the AI agent to make sure I'm getting a good answer.
George, I want our listeners to know that we're working to connect with an expert in this field locally here, and we should have an answer in a week or so about what local health providers' recommendations are about this, because it's surprising to me, was surprising to me, that Essentia and Sanford and you say the network that you participate in Colorado have the doors open. So with a click of the mouse, all your medical records can be sucked in and off we go. So I'm very curious to see what the experts are now saying about it from the health side.
Yep. I'm looking forward to hearing that too.
All right, George, let's talk about a
Where you may be hearing, this on a podcast, on something old fashioned.
On live radio. George, after more than a century, let me ask you this. What does traditional radio still do really well?
What it should do really well, and sometimes does really well, but much less than it used to, was build a local community. And when radio was local, it was local by kind of technical necessity and also to a certain extent local by FCC regulation. It was a resource to build local community. The landscape has changed so much consolidation, so much, and then to a certain extent technology to permit duplication of content. It's lost a lot of that local appeal and local connection. When it still exists, that's really good. I think public radio is much better at that, not universally, but I would say number one is it's supposed to be this local connection. That would be what it does best.
When people talk about radio today, George, I think that in their minds, they meld AM, FM, satellite, and maybe now even streaming services into this thing that's radio. So technologically, where does radio begin and end today? Because right now, as you kind of noted, people can be listening to us either on their radio or guess what? On their computer.
Right. Well, it's funny. I call my internet radio station an internet radio station. Well, it's really not a radio station. We had a very funny example here, I don't know, about 10 years ago. I was volunteering for a public radio station in Denver, and we had a younger social media person. I'm serious, Craig. On National Radio Day, on the radio station website, they put the internet stream and said, "Welcome to National Radio Day." We all thought that was kind of funny. Mm-hmm. but traditionally, you were listening over a wireless device. You were listening in your car or on a radio in your house or a console or some, you know, sitting around with a dial and the Zenith logo and the tubes would warm up going way back. Another funny story, I had a neighbor kid, he was probably about 10 years old at the time and had a little Sony portable radio with the antenna sticking up. And he says, "Dad," my neighbor was here with his kid, "what's that funny pencil holder?" So it's like, you know, there's a whole generation that was lost on radio. And that was the other thing I remember. I mean, I got into the radio business when I was 14 years old, and the radio was how all my friends and everybody in town, we would connect and we would talk about what we heard the night before. And we were all listening to KOMA or KVOW or whatever. It was a way to connect. In the good old days, and to this day, it's still over the air on AM or FM, satellite if you are using an XM Sirius receiver, but virtually all of the programming I just described is also available online. So a lot of it's going that way.
Interesting to me, on your car and on my car, our dashboard has melded together what a radio is, access to a podcast. We can do it in exactly the same way, no dial turning, as you kind of reminisced about a little bit ago. It's all melded together now.
So on mine, it's sometimes confusing when I tap a radio station, whether I'm going to be listening to the stream or listening to over the air. Sometimes I've got to be very specific about which one I choose because I will not know the difference. Just because I'm thinking of it, and I'm not sure about your car, but my car does not have an AM radio.
Yeah, mine still does. I remember you mentioning that. I think that is not a great thing, especially for folks in rural communities.
The reason it's very relevant and I bring it up is that there is legislation now being debated in Congress. And I got an email from a trade firm that I've been associated with asking me to mail or not, probably not that old fashioned, but email my congressman and ask them to vote there is a current provision to require car manufacturers to retain AM radio in their vehicles. And you may not know this, but when FM was kind of a budding and oncoming technology, there was introduced and passed legislation to require FM radios in cars. But now the AM stations are concerned enough that they're no longer relevant and are not going to be retained in a car, which is where the primary terrestrial radio audience is living now, is in an automobile. So the argument is that that local connection, mostly for emergency services, the emergency alert system for a storm or some kind of an emergency, by eliminating an AM radio in a car, you are eliminating that avenue for emergency transmission.
Yeah.
Now, my question to the people sponsoring that legislation is, oh, FM stations, by the way, in case you aren't aware, also have to participate in EAS. So it's a smoke. It's a smoke. And the phones go off. I was in a hotel last year in San Diego, and all our phones went off at once about 15 milliseconds before the room began to shake. So it's there's lots of avenues. The industry is behind it because AM radio is threatened.
Sure.
But AM radio may be mandated to still be in a car.
George, will you define for us what HD radio is? It has been around for a while, yet I think most people have no idea what it is and what it means.
Okay, here's the question. What's the worst thing you can ask an HD radio executive? The worst possible thing. What's HD radio?
Right.
So, all right. If we think about what may be more familiar is HDTV. And HDTV was a huge conversion. The entire television industry converted to HD in, I don't remember now, 2000, maybe even before. I should remember that, but I don't. And you either had to buy a new television if you wanted to watch television off the air, or you had to buy a converter. So it was a conversion from analog to digital, and then from older standard definition to high definition. And then as it was an entirely digital format, it allowed sub-channels. And so now when you have an HD-capable television and you're getting channels over the air, you'll get 9.1, 9.2, 9.3, 9.4, 9.5, 9.1 being the main channel, which is still the CBS or the ABC or Fox affiliate, right?
I think people think those are separate channels.
Okay.
You know.
But then you get the 9.1, 9.2, 9.3, which will be sub-channels, in most cases carrying really tired old reruns.
MeTV.
Okay. But that's what HD television did. So that was a mandated big technology change. Now enter analog radio. AM and FM is analog, which is why you hear interference and dropouts. Well, why don't we look at the same type of a technology change for radio? So enter HD radio, which, by the way, does not stand for high definition. And most people don't know that.
I didn't know that,
and if
George.
You ask anybody or you ask the original vendor, Ibiquity was the name of the company that originally founded it. I don't even know who owns Ibiquity now. But they said, no, it doesn't stand for HD or high definition. Some said it does. It stands for hybrid digital. And then most said it doesn't stand for anything. It was just branding they used to tag, you know, to coat tag onto HD television. Most people don't know it exists. I had a friend, a good friend, that had a nice Lexus with an HD radio in it. She didn't know that it had an HD radio in it, had no idea what HD radio was, and she had an HD radio. So the idea of HD radio, and I'm thinking Prairie Public, most of its stations are HD have HD sub-channels. Mm-hmm. So HD radio gives you the ability, first of all, to broadcast in digital, not analog, which means it can theoretically sound better. But it also allows sub-channels the same way TV does with reruns on HD2 and HD3. And I will say the radio industry, in my humble opinion, squandered horribly the potential for HD radio. Instead of putting beautiful, innovative, new, far-reaching programming on their HD2s and HD3s, all they did was repeat their other stations in the market. Mm. So if you go to a commercial station, their HD1 will be, you know, 97.1 country. Their HD2 will be whatever their 107.5 FM station is playing, you know, R&B. And their HD3 will be their, you know, 92.3 station playing top 40. And the other stations in the market just repeat the same thing. So radio stations squandered the ability to really benefit from HD. And HD radio, in my opinion, largely has completely foundered because of that. And it's just no one even knows what it is anymore.
George, as we kind of wrap up today's conversation, let me ask you this question. I'm very interested in your perspective. You and I subscribe to services. We subscribe to streaming services. We may or may not subscribe to XM Radio. We may or may not pay for our subscription to Pandora or another music service, Amazon Prime or whatever, however you absorb your music. But radio remains free.
Free.
Easy to receive. How important is that? And is simplicity undervalued today?
I mean, it should be, but I still think content is king, Craig, and people pay for content because it's compelling content. I pay for these things, we pay for these things because they're compelling. I don't pay for over-the-air television, partially because I don't think I want to have to pay for Beverly Hillbillies reruns. So the problem is, I think with radio, is it's free, and that's very valuable, but it also tends to diminish its value, I think, to a certain extent. And I think radio has done a very good job of making that value diminish by making content very, very unappealing. It's my opinion.
The Clampets aren't happy, George. George Peck joins us every Thursday for Tech with Peck. It's always a pleasure. Thanks, George.
All right, man. Next week.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for The Middle Live. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Jill Freitas. Too many Indigenous families lack electricity in their homes, but on the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming, a new project is bringing solar power to tribal homes. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman rode along with the crew to check out three homes at different points in the installation process.
And this is the one that's applied for the solar here, this tiny house?
Yeah.
Okay, perfect.
Holly Aragon lives in a repurposed shed with her four-year-old and her boyfriend in the backyard of his family's home in Fort Washakie. Right now, their houses are connected by a thick power cord, running electricity from the main house to the tiny one. But she's excited about someday.
Just being able to like turn on a light and not have to worry about the power cords.
Aragon works at Eastern Shoshone Child Support down the road. She looked into getting connected to the electrical pole that powers the main house, but says just getting hooked up was going to cost $2,400.
Because then it would go off of the whole electricity for the whole house, and I imagine the bill would be up there.
So she applied to the Energize Wind River program, which installs solar panels, a battery, and a backup generator. Foreman Austin Hill is stopping by to check out Aragon's tiny house.
We're just going to take measurements and stuff and kind of take pictures of your home and kind of look in.
Because it gets electricity from that umbilical cord connection to the main house, Aragon's home is a good fit for the program. Hill peeks inside to see what the solar might be able to help power.
A lot of the heat kind of rises in here, and so getting a fan in here would be perfect to kind of push that back down. And
the Energize Wind River crew is mostly made up of folks from the reservation, and the bulk of its funding comes from a Bureau of Indian Affairs grant. So far, they've got three systems totally up and running, with more in the works, like Aragon's tiny house.
See you later.
And with that, Hill and the crew are off to another stop, the Headley house. They live off-grid.
Good morning, Reno.
They've got chickens, donkeys, dogs, and a sassy pig named Jack. Their system is almost complete. All that's left is a few final touches. Jesse Dorothy is in the Headley's kitchen, tinkering with some electrical wires.
I'm a master electrician, born and raised on the Wind River Indian Reservation. I've been at it for over 50 years.
Dorothy's working with some of the young guys on the Energize Wind River crew, who are learning the ropes of the trade.
Just going through and checking everything out and checking the light switches, and everything's working really great.
Dorothy says he hopes the solar program can keep expanding, even as a supplement to those who are on the grid.
If this gets going really great, I'd love to see them on every you know, the elders or the seniors' homes to give them a reduced rate.
Reno Headley says the new system is a godsend and that it's going to be nice to just flip a switch.
There's light. Yeah.
Down the road and through a few turns is Elder Tommy LeBeau's place. His solar is fully set up, hooked into a new trailer that he's renovating and moving into. His old trailer has a wood stove and a gas generator.
I lived, you know, for well over 25 years without electricity, running water, sewers, and stuff like that. I lived the old way, live off the land, you know, best I can in today's modern times.
LeBeau spent a lot of time in the Wind River Mountains. He's a big hunter. Decades ago, he got into a disagreement with a local power company after he was late on paying a bill.
I was gone for 3 months on the Sundance Highway, we call it the Powwow Highway. But anyway, they shut my electricity off for $11.
That didn't bode well for all the meat that was in LeBeau's freezer.
For $11, I'm like, wow, you guys, you spoiled all my food in my refrigerator and my freezer on my wild game.
So LeBeau was wary of utility companies for a long time. But Hill knew LeBeau and told him about what Energize Wind River was up to. And LeBeau got more interested.
I don't have to worry about running to town or to a gas station to get some gas for my generator. So I got to charge my cell phone up and stuff because people forgot how to read smoke signals.
LeBeau's big dream is to get the solar system plugged into a freezer so he can keep hunting and living off the land. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Haberman.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Jill Freitas for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for PrePublic is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 6th. As World War I progressed, North Dakota began to suffer the consequences, even though the state was far from the battlefields of Europe. On this date in 1917, North Dakota newspapers were filled with reports of shortages affecting people across the state. Consumer goods had become scarce as production shifted to support the war effort. Rationing was imposed to conserve food for the troops. Workers relocated to industrial areas, creating housing shortages. The movement of workers to higher-paying manufacturing jobs, along with the 25,000 North Dakotans who entered military service, resulted in a labor shortage. The state even suffered what was called a wool famine, with a relatively small number of sheep in the state and the large amount of wool being used to manufacture military uniforms. Newspapers across the state noted that there was a shortage of almost everything, including meat animals, and predicted that this shortage will continue and that it will become more pronounced rather than otherwise. Demand for meat had increased in Europe as the war disrupted farming, and meat was also being shipped to the troops. One of the issues facing ranchers was a shortage of feed. Ranchers were beginning to panic, and many considered selling off their breeding stock. That would have been a short-term solution, but rebuilding a herd with quality breeding animals would take years. Newspapers pleaded with ranchers not to act hastily and to do their best to feed their herds through the winter. They were urged to hang on as long as you can until you are absolutely certain no other way can be found to carry them through the winter. Farmers were also advised to ignore the alarmists and have confidence in the markets for their crops. One article reminded them that the law of supply and demand will transcend every other law. The destruction in Europe was unfortunate, but it also created an opportunity for North Dakota farmers. The food shortages were alarming, but the frightful waste and destruction of all food supplies created a valuable market for farmers and ranchers. It was considered certain that the war would end, whether this year or next, and North Dakota agriculture was encouraged to take advantage of the opportunity while it lasted. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by the Study ND, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
And that wraps up this Thursday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Coming Monday on Main Street, Understanding Kratom, its uses, risks, and North Dakota's emergency ban. We hope you have a great North Dakota weekend, and we'll see you Monday back here on Main Street.